Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm Dan Perkins. Austin, Texas. Texas ban on selling smokable hemp temporarily lifted by a judge. A Texas judge gave four hemp companies procedural victory on Wednesday, temporarily lifting the state's ban on smokable hemp products. Activists celebrated the win and see it as a sign that the ban will indefinitely be removed as the case moves forward. While Texas legalized the non-intoxicating version of cannabis crop last year, the law was written in a way that only prohibited the manufacture of smokable hemp, leaving an opportunity for businesses to import and sell products from other states. But the state's Department of State Health Services issued an implementation regulations that went into effect earlier this month that go further and explicitly forbid the sale of any smokable hemp products, prompting four companies to file a suit in Travis County District Court. They argued that the ban is unconstitutional and asked the court to make it so companies can produce and sell the items in-state. Judge Livingston has taken preliminary action, issuing the temporary restraining order that enjoins the state from enforcing the ban on smokable hemp products, processing, and sale. The TRO expires on September 2nd, when the court will hold a hearing on the plaintiff's request for temporary injunctive relief. We applaud the judge's decision, Zachary Maxwell, president of Texas Hemp Growers, said in a press release. While today's ruling is not the concrete declaration that the state overstepped its boundaries, it does reinforce the idea that manufacturing, processing, and selling smokable hemp products in Texas is perfectly legal prior to the enactment of the rule on August 2nd. Montpelier, Vermont. Vermont marijuana sale legalization bill caught up in a spat over a seatbelt provision. Key Vermont lawmakers announced on Wednesday that they were working to finalize a bill to legalize marijuana sales by the end of this month, but disagreements over an unrelated provision dealing with seatbelt policy could jeopardize the plan. While the advocates felt encouraged that the conference committee convened to hash out differences between versions of the cannabis legalization passed by the House and Senate, the meeting of the six lawmakers became especially contentious when the discussion turned to the seatbelt rules. The House inserted a section in their version of the marijuana bill that would allow police to pull people over for not wearing seatbelts, a proposal that's been a consistent source of controversy in the Vermont legislature. During the negotiating sessions, the bill's state sponsor, Senator Dick Sears, called the provisions a deal killer. If the House is going to insist on this provision, then we might as well walk away. Representative John Gannon, who chairs the House Committee on Government Operations, responded that this is a critical position for the House that goes to our concern about highway safety. Washington, D.C. In our last story, the Library of Congress highlights racist news coverage used to justify criminalization of marijuana a century ago. The Library of Congress is documenting racist depictions of marijuana in the early 20th century news coverage that helped to drive the criminalization of cannabis, highlighting sensational articles about the plant and that the federal research body says effectively it served as anti-Mexican propaganda. The exhibit points out that from 19th century to early 20th century, newspapers reported the early rise of marijuana post states. Alarming reports of the menace of marijuana reached the United States press. Tales of the alleged atrocities fueled by the drug are often tied to anti-Mexican propaganda. And this has been your American Cannabis Conversation Quick News Update. So let's see who's on the show today. We have Dr. Jordan Tischler, the cannabis doctor on call. And we're talking about further extension of what's going on in the pandemic and how it's affecting his practice. Morgan Fox is going to join us from the National Cannabis Industry Association and talk about some of the legislation that was not happening this year that they're a little bit disappointed on. Stuart Tomkic from CV Sciences will talk about his product line, including his CBD line. And finally, our roving reporter Chase Roberts is going to bring us an interview with Dale Skyer Jones, a lawyer, is the executive chancellor who serves as president and CEO of Oaks Turndon University. If you missed any of today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, the archive section, and download the rest of this show or any other show in our extensive archive. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week. This is Dan Perkins.
Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is our good friend Dr. Jordan Tischler. And we're going to talk about technology today. How do we take cannabis? There's been a product from Gilead Health Science, which has the only FDA emergency approved treatment for COVID-19, which is a series of injections. And they announced this week that they're starting clinical trials on a inhaled or vapor equivalent to it. So I thought about that in terms of cannabis. People don't want to necessarily smoke, and you've got tablets and you've got other edibles. But as I understand it, and I've asked Dr. Jordan to talk about it, how he uses vapors or inhalation or whatever the right word is for his practice, that he could give us some education on why he uses it and why he thinks it's good or bad. So, Dr. Tischler, welcome to the conversation.
Oh, thank you. It's always good to be here.
So, tell us about what is the right word? Is it vaporizer? Is it inhalation? What's the right word for your practice to do that?
Well, you know, I think that the words mean slightly different things. So, let me try to clarify for our listeners a little bit. You know, anything that you inhale would be inhalation. So that would, with regard to cannabis, include smoking, right?
Okay.
But the way I think of this is that there are different ways or different things that one could inhale, some of which are safer than others. And so, you know, the first thing is we probably should stop for a second and say, well, why inhale the stuff at all? And the answer to that is that cannabis behaves differently as a medicine depending upon how we take it. And so inhalation is a method of giving cannabis that has certain characteristics that are particularly helpful in certain circumstances. So anybody who's ever smoked cannabis can certainly attest to the fact that it is relatively rapid in its onset. If you go to the internet and look this up, you can find people saying it's immediate, which is a bit of a stretch. It's quick, but it's not instant. And I think that's important because we want people who are new to this to realize that because it's not instant and takes sort of 10 to 15 minutes to kick in, you can take a lot of puffs on a vaporizer or a joint or something in that 10 to 15 minutes, and that's not something you want to do without some thought to how much you're getting. But that being said, the point is that inhalation is relatively rapid onset compared to most medications. It also has a moderate duration of about 3 to 4 hours before it starts to wear off. So in certain circumstances, that's a very ideal approach to treating things, for example, like a migraine-type headache or nausea, those sorts of things that are episodic or intermittent in their nature. And to contrast that, then we have things you can take by mouth, which are very much the opposite, right? They're slow to start working. And in fact, it can even be a little bit unpredictable as to when they're going to start working. But once they do start to work, they work for much longer, more like 8 to 12 hours. So that's kind of more like our extended release medicine and is useful for things like 24/7 back pain or something like that, where it's kind of more of a continuous nature.
So let me ask you, if I could, a follow up question. I think this is the right way to ask it, but if not, I'm sure you'll educate me. Are there some strains of cannabis that work better inhaled, whether it's through an atomizer or smoke, than others?
No. Thankfully, that's just one variable we don't have to worry about. In general, strains don't vary very much in sort of what they can accomplish for us. And the way in which we take them, or the way in which we take cannabis, doesn't seem to vary so much strain to strain in terms of how you're ingesting it.
Different strains have different levels of THC, is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I think that's one of the areas where we've seen some missteps on the part of the medical side of the industry. But it's also an area where we can sort of differentiate between these strains. Obviously there's a fair amount of emphasis that's put on things like the name of the strain, which turns out to be completely unreliable, and on the sort of classification of that strain into either the indica category or the sativa category. And it turns out that none of these things actually mean anything in any reproducible or predictable fashion. But what we can say is that strains that have more moderate potency, sort of more in that 15 to 20% THC range, are generally more effective for medical purposes compared with the strains that have super high levels of THC. And that has to do with the fact that since this is measured in percentage, the higher the THC level, the less of the sort of accompanying helping chemicals that we would expect to be able to get from cannabis. And what we know is that THC is certainly the main medicine, but it's not effective by itself. We've had THC available as a pill for 30 years as a pharmaceutical, and frankly, it doesn't work very well, so we don't use it very much compared with actual cannabis. And that's because of this process that you've probably heard of called the entourage effect, which basically says that you get a bunch of chemicals from cannabis. THC is sort of the lead actor, but the supporting cast is important too in helping the THC do its job. And without that supporting cast, THC just doesn't do a very good job. So again, sort of those moderate potency strains are going to have a better representation of those helper chemicals that we need.
What I have seen in videos is that there is machinery in the cannabis industry that will take the cannabis plant, pulverize it into a very fine powder, which is then put in an atomizer or puffer or whatever the right word you want to use, that you can take it directly into your lungs. And my question to you is, if I'm going to smoke a joint where I'm going to bring in the smoke versus actually bringing in the plant itself in a pulverized form or powder form, am I getting more power out of the powder than in the smoke, or does it not make any difference?
No, it doesn't quite work that way. So when we smoke it, and I mean this literally, like, so we are lighting the material on fire, essentially what we're doing is we're using heat to liberate these cannabis chemicals, and actually there are some positive transformations, and then we're also producing a bunch of toxins well as some small particulate matter that we don't really want to get in our lungs. And so that's the smoking side of things. And to me, you know, the issue here is, why smoke when we can get the same benefit without the smoke and without those toxins through vaporization? When we talk about vaporization, what we're doing is we're using a device that is smart enough to heat the material to a temperature at which those chemicals that we want as medicines become a steam. And we can inhale that steam, but the temperature is very precisely controlled so that we're making steam, but we're not actually burning the cannabis plant material. So we're not creating those toxins and we're not creating those fine particulates that we want to avoid. And that's the ideal way to do this.
So you're talking
one
about
of these cannabis flower machines.
Is that like a vaping pen or is it a different technology?
Perfect question. Thank you. No, it's very much not like a vaping pen. So the devices that I'm talking about are, generally speaking, slightly larger overall, and you put the ground-up cannabis material into them. And the thing that's crucial about these devices is that they actually have a little computer brain inside, and that brain is measuring the temperature at the heating element and adjusting the feedback so that it goes to the right temperature, which is 350 degrees, and it stays there. And that's the point, is that some vaporizers, ones that are not created well, may get to 350 initially, but as you use them, that temperature drifts up and up and up, and eventually we start to make some of these toxins that we want to avoid. These
right.
vape pens are not really vaporizing, right? The process of vaporizing is not combustion. It's simply making that steam that we talked about. And these
yeah.
little pen things are like dumb little devices that have a battery and a heating element. And so they're not vaporizing that oil in the cartridge. They're burning that oil in the cartridge. And so, yes, you do get some of the cannabinoids, but you're also getting the toxins that are created from burning the oil. And in fact, you know, just like if you are burning motor oil in your car, we know that burning oil creates lots of toxins,
right.
perhaps even as much or more than you would from smoking the botanical material. So I don't recommend combustion for anybody, meaning let's not smoke it. Let's not vaporize, air quotes, the oil. Let's use a true vaporizer that allows us to control the temperature so that we get the medicine without any of the nasties that come along with combustion.
Are these things, these machines, are they expensive?
No, not at all. The one that, it's funny that you ask, because I, first of all, I have no connection specifically. I don't make any money from any of these companies, but I will say that I've been through about 50 or so of these machines to find ones that I think are effective for my patients and also are cost effective. And so there was a machine out there that was a really good machine, but it was about $280 and it was the best that we could get. And subsequently, a newer machine has come on the market that I think is even better and it costs $129. And really
wow.
what I wanted was to get something that was in the low 100 range because that would just simply be more effective, more affordable for people, and they wouldn't have
sure.
to think twice about it. You know, I used
right.
to have patients who would say things like, well, I'd really like to get that vaporizer, but I'm going to have to ask my parents for it for a Christmas gift, you know, and that just seems like that's not an ideal situation.
Right.
So, you know, at $129, this is a much more reasonable price, and I think it's just as effective, in fact, perhaps even slightly more effective than the predecessor. But, of course, it's a newer machine, so we can't really blame the old one. It was doing the best it can. But, yeah, this is not a bank breaker, which is good because, you know, if you're thinking about spending, you know, $60 on an oil cartridge with the handle, the battery handle, and then you're going to buy a couple of those, you know, you can see that pretty soon you've spent more money on a device that's not as good for you
right.
compared with the device that is good for you. And then you can put good old plain old cannabis in it, which is relatively cheap compared to manufactured stuff.
Right.
And so over the course of maybe 3 or 4 months, you've totally come out ahead.
That was very, very helpful and very insightful, and I thank you so much for that. So how do people get a hold of you and find out information about this machine?
Sure. The best way is through my website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com. And we have over 100 articles on that website that are very helpful, and including stuff about vaporization, the good, the bad, the ugly, all of that sort of stuff. So there's lots for you to read And then, of course, you can reach out through the website, and we'd love to hear from you and happy to answer questions.
Super. Always a pleasure, Doctor.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and joining us today is a frequent guest and contributor, Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. And I've invited him on today because I think it's important to talk about. The most recent projection I saw is that cannabis sales may be up as much as 40% for the year in 2020. And I'm curious as to what Morgan and the Industry Association thinks about. What are the near-term prospects and perhaps longer-term prospects for the cannabis industry? So welcome back to the program, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? What does the rest of 2020 look like?
Despite the fact that sales have generally been up, although there's a lot of variance from state to state, as well as even from business to business, the ongoing strains of operating in a pandemic are also creating a bunch of additional costs that aren't necessarily being recouped. Cannabis businesses are still ineligible for PPP loans and other SBA funds, and they still have the traditional problems that they had to deal with, such as overregulation, high regulatory costs, high barriers to entry, and the inability to find banking and extremely high tax rates. So all of these things are stand in conflict with the perception that the industry is doing great and like sales are up across the board. The fact of the matter is that those don't necessarily balance each other out. And there are a lot of businesses out there that are still really hurting. That being said, there is the possibility that we might see some reforms in Congress this year, whether that be through appropriations, through a coronavirus stimulus bill, or through a standalone legislation to get some form of cannabis banking reform, but most likely in the form of the Safe Banking Act. We're still very hopeful that that will happen this year. There's a less of a chance, but still non-zero possibility that something like the MORE Act could actually move forward during this session. Not very, very likely. But it has been revived, particularly in regards to the national conversation around police reform. And obviously, prohibition is one of the major drivers of bad criminal justice policy. There's less of a chance of that happening, but it's something that we're definitely keeping our eye on. Hopefully, if we see some sort of banking reform, then the industry itself will be in a much better position going into next year, and we'll be able to really start working with financial services providers in a way that increases safety and decreases costs all around, allows people to do more job creation, et cetera. In terms of laws, most of the state legislative sessions have ended or are too bogged down with coronavirus-related issues to really address cannabis policy reform, but there are a couple that are still looking at the issue. Whether or not they're able to do so, I think, remains to be seen. But, there has been a lot of talk in New York and New Jersey about pushing things forward. And then we have the ballot initiatives. So, unfortunately, several states were forced to postpone their campaigns due to the pandemic, including Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. The campaign in Idaho is still technically alive and considering suing the state in order to be allowed to gather signatures, but it's unknown whether that will be successful at this time. And time is running short before the election, so it might be a pretty difficult lift, particularly given the lower population density, which can negatively affect petition gathering. We are looking at a number of states that are either will or are likely to have cannabis-related ballot initiatives in front of the voters in November. So Mississippi has actually a couple of different medical initiatives. New Jersey has an adult use initiative. South Dakota is looking at a medical and adult use initiative. And then the ones that are still waiting to find out if they qualify are Arizona for adult use, Montana for adult use, and Nebraska for medical. So it's still possible that we're going to see a number of new states enact more sensible cannabis policies and open up new markets for the cannabis industry.
Going back to what you said early in this call, there seems to be, if I'm correct, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, I won't apologize for that. The dispensaries, whether they are recreational or adult use only for medical, they've got to comply with the COVID-19 precautions within their state, but they're, as you said earlier, they're not qualifying for any financial aid to help pay for these. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And in many cases, they have even more stringent requirements and protocols than other businesses.
Why would that be?
Well, because of the nature of their work and because they are unable to really do cashless transfers in many cases. They have to take extra steps and precautions in order to keep their customers and their workers safe. They also have the same employee protection requirements that have been mandated by Congress as a pandemic relief to deal with as all other businesses, despite the fact that they're not getting any sort of funding or relief from those laws.
So so they've got to comply with the laws. They don't get it. They don't qualify for any of the loans. Do you think that's tied to the nature of the product being a controlled substance and the government can't give them loans for their businesses because at a federal level their businesses are illegal?
Well, it's absolutely the biggest reason, and it could be easily rectified by writing exceptions into these laws. Those have been proposed on several occasions and end up getting stripped out. But you know, for instance, the Small Business Administration could simply change its policy and allow for cannabis businesses to have access to these programs. Congress could make an exception for state-licensed cannabis businesses to be able to receive other federal stimulus funds. They just haven't. And I think a large reason of it is because a lot of lawmakers are still either ignorant of the you know, the benefits that these businesses are providing, or are extremely misinformed as to what regulated cannabis markets look like compared to illicit markets and the benefits that regulated cannabis has for society.
Do you know off the top of your head if there are any states who are providing financial support for the businesses? Because I know a lot of, like I live in Florida, there's money available for small businesses to cover the costs or to begin to defray the cost of compliance with personal protection equipment. Do you know if there's any state programs that would allow a cannabis owner to apply for state funds as opposed to they can't apply for federal funds?
You know, I think that a couple of states are starting to probe that idea. At least one state, New York, has explicitly denied cannabis businesses access to state funds. I think that we're seeing a little bit of support from the states in other forms, such as allowing patients to extend their registrations in medical programs even if they expire, allowing them to renew their license or their registrations via telemedicine. Allowing delivery services where they haven't been allowed before, allowing curbside pickup, just a lot of things that have been denied to the cannabis industry for a long time and are allowed to other businesses the pandemic has sort of spurred a lot of state and local governments to readdress these issues and to work more closely with the cannabis industry to provide some reasonable concessions that other businesses get. And what they're finding is that the cannabis industry can absorb and deal with these abilities and these concessions just like any other business can, and do so effectively and safely. And that is definitely helping, although clearly some sort of state-based loan or relief programs would be beneficial and would save a lot of businesses and save a lot of jobs.
The states who have decided that they're going to allow the sale both either medically or adult use and allow these businesses to go in and to collect revenue, knowing that it's quote against the law on a federal standpoint, but yet they're what they're doing is taking the revenue from the dispensaries and not providing any support or minimal support. That seems to me almost immoral.
Well, this is an issue that's kind of ubiquitous among state leaders and regulators when they're looking at the cannabis industry. I think many of them, unfortunately, look at it entirely as a revenue source and want to try to squeeze as much money out of it as possible without recognizing that you have to support these businesses as well in order to keep that revenue flowing, and that by doing things like providing relief funds or loans and actually decreasing taxes in many cases, that you would have more tax revenue coming in the long run because it makes these businesses better able to survive and thrive and transfers more sales into the legal market than the illicit market.
Was the illicit market anyway at all impacted by COVID-19? Did it change the habits of people?
I've been reading a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests that the illicit markets are hurting pretty severely. And I think that, you know, some people ascribe that to wanting to, just want to get more and not being able to find reliable sales with their traditional illicit market suppliers. But I think it's really more of a combination of both things. The first being public safety. I think that people are a lot more cognizant of where their cannabis is coming from, and they want to get it from a source that is quality controlled and is implementing reliable and verifiable safety controls, and to know exactly where their products are coming from, as opposed to completely unregulated and potentially very unsafe unregulated sources. So that's, I think, the biggest reason that the illicit market has been hurting. I think some secondary reasons are that the pandemic is greatly affecting supply lines, whether they be legal or illegal. And illegal sources usually have a harder time, adjusting to a supply line interruption.
So do you think that the illicit market is perhaps under more pressure than the legal market?
I think it's difficult to compare, but we are seeing a lot more of a transfer of sales from the illicit to the legal market. I think that while at the same time the illicit market doesn't have to deal with things like overtaxation or lack of access to banking or any of the other business related restrictions that apply to legal businesses, they just have to not get caught. So I think it's fair to say that it's difficult to compare the stressors that are being placed on the two, because it's really like apples and oranges in many cases.
Yeah, I've got time for just one more question. There have been a number of articles written that the 40% growth in cannabis sales in the United States is driven primarily by the richness of the unemployment benefit, of the bonus of an additional $600 a week in unemployment benefits. Do you think any of that's true?
I think that that's a little bit dubious of an assertion, but it's possible that that does have an impact in some consumers. But without some real definitive data, I would be a little bit wary of just accepting that at face value. I think what's much more likely is that we're seeing slight upticks in consumption because of perhaps stress or anxiety, or deciding that they want a safer alternative to alcohol, particularly when there are a lot more health concerns to worry about and when people are stuck at home. But I think it's also very, very much a case of that used to frequent the illicit market taking their business to legal and regulated stores instead for safety reasons.
Super. Well, thank you for joining us today. We've been speaking to Morgan Fox of the National Cannabis Industry Association, talking about what's going on in the industry today. Thank you for joining us today, Morgan.
Thanks again for having me.
You bet.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost one in five dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us again is Stuart Tomick from CV Sciences. And we want to talk about the benefits that using CBD or cannabis might have on the impact of COVID-19. Stuart, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Dan. It's so exciting to be here. And we are lucky to be able to have this conversation. What I mean by that is because the law is changing and because the interest in cannabis is coming out of the shadows, we are able to really look at how the cannabinoids are different than the other compounds in nature that we all had access to before the cannabinoid disruption. What do I mean by that? The other things that I rattle off quickly, like ashwagandha or kava, some of these other things that have been used and are used to help people deal with stress, they contain different molecules. They contain these alkaloids, and that they behave differently. And what I love so much and what scientists are so excited about with cannabinoids is that they are immuno- and neuromodulatory. So they modulate the immune system in a way that's different than, say, global steroids. Steroids can shut down the entire immune system. And did you see that report a couple of weeks ago, Dan, that showed a relatively inexpensive steroid had some tremendous treatment effect with patients that were suffering the cytokine storm? Did you catch that story? A very inexpensive steroid, right?
Yes.
You saw that, right?
Yes.
Now, why am I making that point? Cannabinoids, they work more like that, where they don't block everything, they modulate. So when we say immunomodulatory, you want something that's going to modulate the hyperactive immune response. And you also want something that may also have some powerful anti-inflammatory effects. And rarely do you get those things. Never have I seen that you get those things together. And this is where people have a tendency to oversell and overhype the potential benefit of cannabinoids. However, I'm sure you've seen reports recently that they're looking at different cannabinoids under the lens of COVID as something to help modulate this immune inflammatory response. And we might end up seeing drugs approved by the FDA that are derived from cannabis to treat this and other virulent conditions, and that will really lend credibility to all of the years people have supported the plant.
You know, Stuart, speaking of that situation, I had on the show about maybe a month ago
head of a research team in British Columbia that is doing exactly that. They're doing a Canadian, in essence, Food and Drug Administration controlled study on the impact of cannabis on a treatment for COVID-19. And what he was saying to me was that COVID-19 is a functionally an infection. And as you just pointed out, cannabis has tremendous ability to fight infections. So they're doing the phase one trial, and they hope to be in phase two by the end of the summer. But if we could use an all-natural product, cannabis, to attack the virus and clear up the infection, we would have a huge, as you said, a huge opportunity to add more legitimacy to the cannabis marketplace and what it can do to try and heal people. Interesting, in the current show that's on the air right now, I did a story from Dr. Oz where he talked about he had a meeting. He didn't understand why the government was so opposed to legalizing cannabis. And initially he was not, quote, in favor of it, but he couldn't give a rationale why it should be. He met Montel Williams, who has been on cannabis treating his illness, and he monitored him for months just to see what was happening. And he finally called and had an interview with people from the CDC and from FDA, and they both admitted it was bureaucracy that was creating a problem. He says, this is such a good thing. We need to get out of the road and allow it to be expanded and modified. And they both agreed. So, but it hasn't happened. But I understand what you're saying, that we find out more things about cannabis every day and what it can do other than just pure recreational. So,
that's why I can't wait to come back on your show, because as a publicly traded company that's playing both horses, the pharma side and the dietary supplement side, and maybe eventually the recreational side, I hope as more people are listening, they can hear there's something here for everyone. There's a huge market here.
I believe that both with cannabis and CBD, we have not given either one of them justification. I mean, I know that we have approximately 46 states that now allow CBD to be sold. The other four are still haven't gotten the legislation done. But with my own personal experience, we talked about on our last show about CBD for sleep and taking it before bedtime. I, as you know, have a foundation called Songs and Stories. And one of the things I suggest to veterans who have sleep deprivation, which is a huge problem for decades after your service, get yourself a Fitbit so you can monitor the quality of your sleep, and think about using CBD just before you go to bed and see if it helps. I get lots of feedback from people who said I've slept better. I don't sleep well every night, but I've had more good night's sleep using the CBD product than I can ever remember. And yet we don't have anybody per se, you're talking about it, but the government's not talking about it. Even the VA won't allow veterans, or active duty to use CBD because if there's any trace of THC, they could be discharged and lose their pension. So there's still a lot of stupid things that are going on that are stymieing the ability to bring this wonderful drug, natural drug, to the marketplace to help people with so many problems.
Well, that's the reason why the science is so important. And because I've had this experience one other time in my life, I'm biased and I think I know what's going on. Let me explain. I worked in the fish oil industry for nearly a decade, and I watched grandma's cod liver oil turn into a big time seller, became a competitive market, turned into an FDA-approved drug, turned into another FDA-approved drug, which turned into standard of care. And now they were making fun of you for wasting your money on omega-3, and now they have a prescription for pure EPA, 98% EPA, that lowers death 25% that's a prescription approved by the FDA. So we are still early. We're very early in the investment. We're early in the cycle. And I think that the rate limiting factor is the science. Because as you know, Dan, and some of your listeners might know, that the reason that we're still hung up with the federal government is because of these international treaties that go back that we signed that said we weren't going to trade in narcotics. And so we doubled down again in 1970, I believe, one or two with the psychedelic drug treaty. In any case, like, this is all going to get changed as the science proves that this is something that can help humanity. So that's why we have to keep beating the drum and knocking on FDA's door and knocking their door down rather than just standing out in the street saying that you people need to give us our plant.
Tell us about some of the products that you have and what you've been experiencing is what's how they're helping people. Because that's really what we want to do is we want to try and provide information to people, a place to go, and to look about a product that might help a particular ailment or problem they have. So tell us some more. Tell us some things about some of your products.
Yes, we have a gold soft gel. We call it our extra strength. It's a patented process where we've taken full spectrum food fiber hemp extract and we distill it through short path distillation. We do this. We created this. This is our own secret sauce, our Coca-Cola product. So we're using the seed and the stem and the stalk, so we have all the fatty acids and the plant sterols. We have 500 bioactive compounds working together. Why? We're competing against people selling pure isolated CBD, right? We're not in the powder business. We're in the hemp extract business. So we've taken this gold oil, and we've actually subjected it to formal toxicology work. We published in the Journal of Toxicology. Then we conducted a randomized control trial. So we gave one gold soft gel, only 15 milligrams of CBD, and a whole bunch of naturally occurring hemp bioactives to 65 healthy people, and they ate less. They ate less. They felt more satisfied. They slept better and longer, and they self-reported enhanced quality of life, and their HDL cholesterol, good cholesterol, went up. So that we published that in the Journal of Dietary Supplements. That's available. Then we published safety data where we tracked the sale of 5 million bottles of the same product. So let's get this right. We selected it, we grew it, we extracted it, we made it, we proved it was safe, we conducted a randomized control trial, then we sold 5 million bottles and published those safety results in the Journal of Dietary Supplement, proving that it was safe. So all you can say right now about CBD that's a dietary supplement is A, FDA still says it's not a dietary supplement. I'll say that again. Mm-hmm. FDA says it's still not a dietary supplement. So what do you do if you're a company like CD Sciences? You act like it is. And everything I just explained to you is what will be required when they say, can you prove it's a dietary supplement? They're going to say, can you prove it's safe? Can you prove it's effective? Did you sell a whole bunch of it? Did you track the results? Can you hand us the paperwork? The answer is yes. So CV Sciences, CVSI, is early on in this, as every other company is early on, because FDA still says it's not a supplement.
Are they as aggressive about condemning it as they have been, or are they talking it?
Oh, no, they're so distracted with what's going on right now. That's why you have to just make high-quality products and then publish science. So that's what we do. And I know I almost seem like the anti-salesperson, but I want people to go to PubMed.gov, PubMed.gov, and read about the work we've done. I don't know if you saw this. We did an open-label pilot trial with like 80 people using 15 milligrams a day, and 80% of them reported a reduction in anxiety. Do you know what that could mean for public health right now with what's going on? For $1 a day, people could manage their stress? Whoa!
Yeah. Yes. Agreed.
That's cool.
And so they
finally
can buy
a roll-on. We have a roll-on. You can buy it at pluscbdoil.com, pluscbdoil, or your local health food store.
And I can personally attest to the roll-on because I use it every day. And I have a neck problem. And it helps me every day. And I had a shoulder problem and it helped me. So it's not a paid endorsement, ladies and gentlemen. It's just, I'm telling people I use it and it worked for me.
Quick, can I say one thing about this? Quick, one thing about the roll-on, please, really quick.
Thank you,
because a lot of natural shoppers would not use that product, and I'll tell you why. Because it's an over-the-counter camphor and menthol. It's Bengay mixed with CBD. So it's nature and science. I mean, it's really, is that a drug? Right, you know, is it a supplement? What is it? It's in a weird new area. And so that's why I wanted you to try that, because the skin is loaded with these receptors, and you might get as much pain relief just rubbing that on topically and not take it internally at all. For a lot of people, maybe more conservative people, more scared people, more religious people, they can have that benefit and then maybe get more comfortable with the plant, decaf instead of regular, the hemp plant. We call it decaf.
Okay. So they can get, where can they buy that again, Stuart?
PlusCBDOil.com. It's the roll-on, PlusCBDOil.com, the roll-on.
And I'm sorry to say, with Stuart, we're out of time again. So we've been speaking to Stuart Tomick from CV Science. And what's the website again to buy product, Stuart?
PlusCBDOil. That's P as in Paul, LUSCBDOil.com, PlusCBDOil.com, and YouTube, CV Charlie Victor Sciences at YouTube.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today, Stuart.
My pleasure, Dan.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Chase Roberts, recording for W420 Radio Network, and today I'm speaking with...
Hi, I'm Dale Sky Jones, Chancellor for Oaksterdam University.
And yes, today you were at the ICBC conference. You were a moderator. What was your panel about?
Mergers and acquisitions, finding good quality partners, and making sure that those relationships not only last, but if they do need to part, they do so on equitable terms.
And what is the primary function of what you do? Who's your target audience? Who's involved with your network?
Well, Oaksterdam University was first founded in 2007, and we've had over 40,000 students from over 40 countries go through our doors since then. We teach both on campus in Oakland, as well as a new campus opening, or I should say reopening, in Los Angeles. And we're also online. And so we have everyone from patients and their caregivers through investors, regulators, business people, folks just trying to find a job. So our network includes the folks that went all the way to the Supreme Court on this issue to fight for our original rights to access medical cannabis, all the way through folks that just graduated high school and are trying to find their careers.
So this positively affects pretty much everyone. And what kind of courses do you offer?
Oaksterdam University has two core programs. One is the business of cannabis, and the other is the horticulture program. That is the only hands-on hort lab in the world where students can come and get real-life experience with the plants. The business program, we've just expanded, and so we're adding new programs within the business program as we go. So 2020 is a really exciting year. Then we also have different electives and special one-off classes. We hold things like job fairs and graduations, great networking opportunities.
And do you find, with the boom in the industry, that your student population has grown immensely?
I would say that our student population has evolved immensely. And it's interesting now, I realize that I'm almost more conservative in the room with some of my graduates about being out and being a mom with cannabis with my own PTA. And so I get inspiration from the students that walk through our door who are trying to not just have this be transactional, but but in fact transformational. Try that again. The inspiration that I get is from the students that come through the door wanting this to not just be transactional, but transformational. And part of what we teach at the school is not just how to make money in the industry, but also how to be involved in your community, which is ultimately going to improve your bottom line. How do you get involved with equity and making sure that you're hiring people that look like the community that you serve, including having women in leadership? Notice I didn't say women. Multiple.
Yeah.
And again, it's good for your bottom line. And so what I try to do with Oaksterdam is set people up for success, prepare them for the worst, because folks are trying to understand how to relate their own personal experience and goals to this industry. And it's important for us to teach the risks and responsibilities before we teach you how to get into trouble with it. But that said, it's also about tithing back to the folks that got us here in the first place, that as we try to work on retail and adult sales, that we remember that this is still medicine for veterans, for patients, for parents that are trying to save their children. And so while we can make money off of the retail and the adult sales, how do we tie back to the community, whether it be a compassionate veterans cannabis program or your local Boys and Girls Club? Because again, as you save the world, you're also improving your business and your competitiveness in your community.
Amazing. I love the consciousness of staying in touch with the community. And I really want to ask you about being a woman in the industry, few and far between. How do you feel about that? Or how do you see that growing?
Coming from more of a corporate America background, I entered this back in 2007 with doctors. And it was a female doctor that I first worked with as her business manager, because she saw so many patients through her mainstream hospital that she was disallowed from discussing cannabis. And we would sit and wonder, why did we not see more women through her practice? And we would see the same reflection in our school. And it seemed as though for the longest time, the only people that came out to talk pro-cannabis were the types of people that, let's be honest, your mama does not want you to grow up to be like. And it took women being out loud. For myself, it was accidental and against my will, but I became the spokeswoman for the first statewide campaign in the nation since the 70s to legalize cannabis. And suddenly it was a pregnant mother saying, hey, you know what, we can actually save our children by ending prohibition, by controlling, taxing, and regulating who sells this, who IDs our kids, who decides what's in the product. And so it took women being out front, people like Debbie Goldsberry or Mickey Norris, being out front to say, I see you, you're like me, I can do what you do. And suddenly all these women are coming up and coming out, and because this industry wasn't built yet, it was still just a movement, it was largely women who had the opportunity to determine their own path. And it really wasn't until the massive investments came in 2016, that you saw the percentage of women in leadership start to dwindle and drop to almost be the same as other major industries. And that's what scares me, is we were 10 points ahead of other industries. We were doing better with women, minorities, and veterans. We're all kind of in the same bucket here.
Yes.
In leadership. And it's an unfortunate reality that investment opportunities tend to come to white males. And so it's extraordinarily difficult for women to get the financing, minorities and veterans as well, to get the financing, the opportunities, the introductions, to get into the right rooms in order to achieve that. And so it's just, I think, incumbent upon all of us to have higher expectations of one another, that if we do business with someone, that we ask them, how are you tithing back to your community, and show me your women in leadership, where are your veterans, where are your equity partners, how are you leaving it better than you found it. And if you're not doing that, you're not going to work with me. I think people will meet the expectations that we set for them in this industry. We can demand better from each other.
Amazing. Agreed.
Very fun.
Now, I want to thank you for your time, but where can people find you?
OaksterdamUniversity.com will tell you everything you need to know about how to come on campus, or we are also on the road with seminars in 2020, but wherever you are in the world, you can always take Oaksterdam from your couch in your boxer shorts online.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, Dale. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Chase.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.